south, and there's communities in the north that just have that one shot. They have that one chip that comes in. So challenges to procurement, supply chain, contractors, and things are built differently in the north, as you can imagine.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 123, episode 123 of the Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector. My guest on the podcast today is...
Ernest Douglas, President and CEO of Kulik Energy Corporation.
Ernest joined me for a chat about the challenges and strategies of providing electricity in Nunavut, a territory with 25 separate independent microgrids, all powered entirely by diesel. The company aims to transition to renewable energy with solar and wind projects around the corner, and eventually larger developments like the Iqaluit Hydro Project and the Kivalliq Hydro Fiber Link. We talk about the importance of local content, the challenges of getting people and equipment to the territory, and the housing crisis. Ernest highlights the need for innovative solutions, perhaps one day with small modular reactors, to address the high cost and environmental impact of diesel. We close the conversation with Ernest's book recommendation. Here is my conversation with Ernest Douglas, recorded in person in Ottawa in mid-September 2025. Ernest, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to an in-person edition of the podcast. Thankfully, we're not on Zoom. It's great that you're passing through Ottawa. So welcome.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start off with just maybe a little bit of basic information about the company, because I don't think a lot of people will be conversant with the details of the company that you run as they would be with some of the larger companies in the south, shall we say, in the lower, below the 60th.
Absolutely. So Kulik Energy Corporation is a territorial wholly owned by the government of Nunavut, Crown Corp. That has the mandate to produce and distribute electricity in Nunavut. So all of the customers that use electricity, all the residents in Nunavut that use electricity, is generated by us.
Right. And I don't recall seeing a map that shows a highway going up to Nunavut. So like everything has to come in by air or by sea in the summer months, and in addition to that, your generation options are limited as well. So how is electricity produced in the territory? And then let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges of actually, you know, getting the stuff that you need to actually produce kilowatts.
Yeah, so we're 100% diesel-generated utility.
Okay.
We have 25 independent microgrids, one for each of the communities within the territory of Nunavut.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, there's no ability, there's no road or infrastructure to share electricity between communities.
Mm-hmm.
So the 25 independent microgrids are maintained by local folks that are on the scene there in each of the communities.
Yeah, and so each of those communities, that's got to raise challenges with respect to redundancy because they're not connected. So does every single community have to have some kind of redundancy in their system?
Yes, so the design for a typical diesel-generated power plant is an N-1, which means you size your generators properly so that when you lose your biggest one, you have a redundant generator to pick up that load. So... But again, a lot of these power plants are very aged, so the infrastructure is quite old.
Yeah.
Many built in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology is starting to be difficult. We can't integrate new technology with the older plants. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. And then, as I said earlier, one of the challenges I expect would be even just getting equipment to the north, because there isn't a road system from the south to the north, much less between the communities. So absolutely, just to clarify, absolutely everything that you need is going to come in on a plane or come in on a boat?
Yes, most of it comes in on sea lift in the summer months. So if you're planning for a project, that planning has to be spot on.
Because you have just a window.
You bet, and you're not going to Princess Auto or the hardware store to get things you need for your project.
Yep.
They have to come from the south, so it all has to be very meticulously planned in order to get to the right community.
Yeah. So I imagine, I mean, we can get into some of the details, but I imagine understanding logistics and supply chains is a big part of your job and the job of your members of your team.
Yeah.
With that short window.
Yeah, we have a great team. Our operations folks, engineering and operation folks are very well planned. We rely a lot on contractors as well.
Okay.
They facilitate the construction of our major projects. And we have a pretty good procurement shop that looks after all these things. And there's some specific Nunavut requirements that we have to follow as well around the benefit agreements and things like that. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's a very interesting process.
Right. So the benefit agreements and the procurement, that's for local benefits. And how would that sort of manifest itself, just as an example?
Yeah, so in terms of contracting or procuring things, we have to make sure that we have local content as much as possible, and when there's not, we need to be able to defend that there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Construction projects, we have a minimum of 20% Inuit content in terms of labor, supplies, and things like that.
Yep.
And that can get difficult if there's two projects or three projects going on.
At the same time?
At the same time.
Okay, yeah. Yep. Yeah. And then so where does the 80% non-Inuit workforce come from in these projects? Is people coming from across the country, flying in?
Yeah, we rely on Southern Canada for most of that. We have a lot of business out of Montreal and Western Canada, Edmonton too. Some of our major contractors are from Montreal and Edmonton.
Yeah. Okay, right.
Yeah.
And so I imagine that the plan is to, over time, one day become less reliant exclusively on diesel generators. Ideally, what would that non-diesel future, or at least partial non-diesel future, begin to look like? Hydro, you and I've talked about a project that you're hoping will come online at some point in time, but maybe talk a little bit about that project and then let's chat about what else. Because you do have, I think you were saying earlier, 15 megawatts is what you would see initially, and then maybe one day 30 megawatts.
Yeah, so renewable energy in the north is proven to be difficult, but we can benefit from all the things that were done and all the mistakes that were made in the renewable energy in terms of connecting to the grid and things like that.
Yeah.
So we're able to benefit from being slow at it.
Yeah.
Renewable energy in the north is basically wind turbines and solar. You can imagine that if you're north of 60, the solar productivity is not the greatest in the winter months.
Right. But in the summer, it's displacing diesel.
That's right. It should displace diesel for the entirety of the summer months.
Right.
So there's some interest in that. I view this as really two steps, because diesel infrastructure is very reliable. We have a fantastic reliability rate. And we can't transition completely off that immediately.
Right.
So I see the transition phase being diesel hybrid power plants, those that are able to accept renewable energy when it comes on, local energy.
Yep.
So we're starting to build our plants with the ability to integrate that renewable energy when it comes available.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is currently, and then the next stage would be including battery storage and the microgrid controller within the contract design of the power plant, so we're a little bit one step closer. And then eventually, as more renewable energy comes on, we can continue to reduce that number of liters of diesel fuel that we burn every year, which is exorbitant. So that's the kind of transition step. The two big projects that are exciting are both Inuit-owned projects. One is the Kalaalit Hydro Project, which is approximately the basin's the reservoir is approximately 60 kilometers north of the city of Iqaluit. And we're told that that's about between 15 and 30 megawatts capacity, which is very exciting for us because that will be firm capacity for the city of Iqaluit. And then the other one in central Nunavut is the Kivalliq Hydro Fiber Line, which
that
is,
would be the link to Manitoba?
That's the link to Manitoba. So Manitoba has committed 50 megawatts of energy. And then there are five central communities in the Kivalliq region that will benefit from that transmission line.
So doing the math, that would, if you had the, that project, that would reduce the number of microgrids that you, that you're running, separate grids from 25 to 20. You still got those 20. Iqaluit, if you may manage to get that plant built sometime in the future, that takes Iqaluit off. You still have the majority out there as separate independent systems. How, and these are not particularly large. Once you take Iqaluit off, right, you're talking about relatively small communities.
What
kind of size are we talking about here?
Quite small.
Yeah,
so, I mean, if you think about it this way, the entire population of Nunavut is around 40,000 people.
Right.
Okay. Iqaluit, I think, is somewhere in the 8,000 being the largest. And then I believe Rankin Inlet, Aqviet, and Baker Lake are maybe the next ones. And I think that they're probably around 3,000 to 4,000.
Right.
Not sure on the numbers.
Yeah.
But there are some communities, like we have some northern communities that have, you know, less than 500 people. So when you think about building a power plant, and I can share some numbers here because they're public, but, you know, roughly $60 million to build a power plant in a community that has 244 people.
Right.
Your return on investment is not there. So we need to have more renewable energy. And that's, I feel, my role in the organization is to get us to the point where we're ready to accept it when it's available. We don't have the capital to build it. But we can remove the barriers for the independent power producers to come in and produce the energy, and we'll buy from them.
Right, right. So how far away are we from that you mentioned, you know, interest in wind and solar? Sounds like, are we, is that way, way down the track, or is it kind of around the corner? What's your sense when we're going to start seeing those kinds of projects?
It's exciting because we were hoping to have our first renewable generation online. That's not net metering and solar, small scale.
Solar, okay.
The larger IPP programs. We were hoping to see some this year. Fortunately, there was a delay. So we do have a wind tower that's being constructed by an organization called NNC, which is a subsidiary of the Kikitani Inuit Association, which is a birthright organization. So we rely on these development corporations, and they're the same organization that's proposing the Iqaluit Hydro Project.
Okay.
So Sanikiluaq, which is the southernmost community in Nunavut, it's actually the islands that are in Hudson Bay, just west of Quebec. There's a wind tower that will be erected and should be producing 1 megawatt of energy next year with a battery system in place. And we have a solar array in a community called Naliat, which is almost right in the center of Nunavut.
Okay.
It's, I think, basically right on the Arctic Circle. It's 60 degrees latitude.
Okay.
And we're excited about that too. And that should start producing energy in 2026.
Okay, well. So it really is right around the
it's
corner.
Close. Both of them are close.
Right, right. Delays, you said that at least for one of the projects, it was delayed. You were expecting a little bit earlier. Were the delays as a result of supply chains that everybody's complaining about these days, or was it just something separate from that?
There were a few issues, but not entirely supply chain.
Okay.
Yeah, there were some issues, smaller issues around supply chain, but I know there were more complications than that.
Right, right. Okay, so that's wind and solar at least starting around the corner. How far off are these other two projects? We're recording in Ottawa. For the listener, this is September 16th, so Parliament just came back yesterday. We've heard talk of projects of national importance. Are you hoping that the next list of major projects might include some of these projects?
Yes, absolutely. So there's two electricity projects that we previously mentioned that we're hoping will be on the list for the Bill C-5.
Yeah.
So that's the Iqaluit Hydro and the Kivalliq Hydro Fiber Link, which is the link to Manitoba. Both of those, I would say that they're nation-building projects.
Right.
They're necessary.
Yeah.
I think that they would allow the folks that are living in the north, Nunavummiut, a lot more benefit to be able to consume clean energy.
Yeah.
Currently, they can't.
Right, right, yeah. And I imagine the challenge for these projects isn't simply C5 attempts to make it easier to permit projects that are identified as in the national interest, but it's more than just permitting, right? These projects are going to be a challenge from a financing standpoint.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Major funding is needed for both of them.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. It is not inexpensive to produce energy in Nunavut.
Mm-hmm.
If you can imagine, unfortunately, our ratepayers pay the highest rates for electricity in Canada, if not the world, I'm not sure, but it's incredible and we cannot burden them anymore. So these projects have to be heavily funded.
Mm-hmm.
And QEC, or Kulik Energy Corporation, kind of has a bit of, we're a stakeholder. We want to make sure that these projects are run, managed well, and are successful, because the worst thing that can happen is a failure in one of these green energy projects. It will just set us back so far.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of administrative work in the back end to make sure that we have policy in place and barriers reduced so that these projects are successful.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I ask folks that come on the podcast, Ernest, is about their journey. Always interested to get a sense of kind of where people came from before they landed where they are. So I always make the joke. Here you go, Ernest. When you were a kid on the playground, did you always dream of running a power corporation north of 60? What was your journey to this role?
Yeah, it certainly wasn't linear.
Yeah.
I'm sure you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe a series of mistakes, perhaps. Who knows? But I think the important thing is capitalizing on the decisions that you made. I'm a geologist by trade. I went to school, I studied geology, and that kind of got me into the energy business early. So mm-hmm. I used to work with the Canadian government when I was a student offshore Nova Scotia.
Okay.
Actually mapping constraints to oil and gas development.
So you're not a northerner.
Not a northerner.
You're from the Atlantic Canada.
I'm a maritimer.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay.
And so I kind of missed the opportunity for the oil industry when the boom happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up in Toronto, actually, as a health and safety professional, which shaped my career really well.
Oh, wow.
And I worked in Toronto and surrounding area for quite a while. And the majority of my career, actually, as a health and safety professional.
Mm-hmm.
The supervisor I had was keen and put me with a lot of civil contractors because I knew dirt. And I got into the pipeline industry, which kind of was on the contractor side at first. And then I had the opportunity to move back to Nova Scotia and take a job at a utility. So I learned the utility side of the industry. I just reached a point where I thought that I could give more. I got into Indigenous relations with this organization, and I really became passionate about supporting what I could support for Indigenous relations, understanding, learning the culture, doing my part. And you know, it's kind of a buzzword, but reconciliation.
Yeah.
But take action on it. And when this opportunity came to be able to do that in the North, I thought, well, this is, you know, a phenomenal opportunity for me. So I thought I had some more to give. So I decided to take the opportunity.
Yeah. And so you've been in the role now for how long?
16 months.
Okay.
Yeah. Still fairly new.
Yeah.
But I feel like I got a lay of the land. I guess the most difficult thing, besides being away from my family all the time, of course, is the government aspect. So I really didn't have a lot of political acumen. But I think, you know, being so close to the government there and working closely with them, I'm starting to learn that a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's jump back to what, you know, what some of the challenges are. Energy use in the territory, you know, you mentioned the rates are higher there than anywhere else in the country and perhaps internationally. But I guess people in the South wouldn't appreciate the criticality of that, because in the South you've got other options, right? If that, you know, if you think that the electricity is too expensive, you know, you've got natural gas, you've got, you know, there are no other options here, right? And so, what is the, like, typically, what does the energy use look like for a residence in the North? Is it all electric and powered by diesel?
No. So the electricity usage in the North is really electricity only. It's not, it doesn't, the heating load we do not have.
Yeah.
And so that's another option with these renewable projects, especially if we have, you know, firm base load, we can take on the heating load. Because, so I'll throw a number at you. I think that we consume 53 million liters on average a year of diesel fuel to generate electricity. But
right.
We're just one third of the amount of diesel fuel that's consumed in Nunavut, because the heating load is a big one.
Right.
And transportation as well.
Okay.
So,
So it's not electricity, but it's all diesel.
Right.
So and all energy use is basically diesel, whether it's transportation, heating,
and
electricity generation.
And the communities have grown to outsize our power plants, so we're very careful, to make sure that, you know, we know what the load is. It's something that we pay attention to very closely.
Yeah, no, I'd imagine. And you also, I think, have challenges with respect to housing in the North as well, right? I mean, it's a real issue. People complain a little bit in the South about housing, but I think it pales in comparison to some of the challenges that, at least that I've read about in the territory. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it really does. That's one of the hardest things that we encounter. One of the biggest challenges we encounter when we're trying to recruit is that we don't have housing for folks to come to Nunavut. So.
Right.
There are challenges. I mean, the government put in place in their mandate in this assembly, Nunavut 3000, which is 3,000 homes built, I think, by 2030. Don't quote me on that, but I think that was the original game plan.
Yeah.
It's incredibly hard. Like, the construction materials, the labor, all that, they go through the same thing we do. It has to come up through the shipping lanes once a year on the sea lift. And I mean, some communities have more than one ship a year, but often there's communities in the North that just have that one shot. They have that one ship that comes in. So challenges to procurement, supply chain, contractors, and things are built differently in the North, as you can imagine, because it's permafrost. So
right.
There needs to be piles driven for most of these homes, because they need to have firm footing.
Right.
And that's part of the problem, is that the older housing that was built years and years and years ago it's just not safe because it shifts so much with, mm-hmm. with the permafrost.
Right, and then the failure of some of the current housing means you've got multi-generations that are now jammed into...
Yeah, it really is, and it's an, it's too bad because there's a lot of... there's a lot of things that stem from that, mm-hmm. you know, I'm aware of, I've heard stories where people rotate beds, you know, just because their sleep schedule is different. They,
yeah.
you know, they share a bed with somebody else because there's just no place.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you said that presents challenges with respect to recruiting and getting people up there. Mm-hmm. So when you're making a pitch, if you're, you know, looking at hiring, an engineer or something. What's the pitch to them to come up to the territory and work for your company?
So it's all around experience.
Yeah.
You know, experience and challenge. Yeah, for a challenge, you know, we have fantastic people working for us. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have been there for a long time, which is remarkable.
Right.
It's because they like a challenge. Nothing is straightforward. There's always a different hurdle. And what that tends to do, you can look at that two ways. You can, you know, beat yourself up and worry about how yourself and the problems all the time, or look at the opportunities in that, because there's a lot of innovative ideas that come out because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is something that we pitch, is that you have an opportunity to make a change, a difference, learn and grow in your career. A lot of people, there's not a lot of new engineers that are coming out of school that have diesel generating experience either, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's new, it's different. Hopefully it's not around for more decades, but, you know.
It's going to be there for the foreseeable future,
it's
though.
It's there for,
right?
You know, we're building four power plants currently, and,
right.
You know, we're talking 40-year lifespan for those power plants.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay. So one of the other things that I did want to chat a little bit about, given that, you know, you've got this background as a health and safety professional, and you worked previously with an electricity company in the South, are the challenges different in the North when it comes to health and safety? It's got to be a different set of risks and threats from an OHS standpoint.
Yeah, I would say that it's completely different.
Okay.
Yeah, like flipped on its end over end. Really.
All right.
Yeah.
How so? What is it? What's the...
Well, I mean, in a lot of these situations, we have two employees that are working in a remote community.
Okay.
So there's only two people there.
Yeah.
Presents challenges when somebody's off or somebody needs to take leave or vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the risks. Generating electricity is a dangerous...
To begin with, yeah.
Yeah, it's dangerous to begin with. And now you're challenged with, you know, the climate and remote work and, you know, being far away from healthcare centers and
mm-hmm.
all kinds of things. And there's a list that I can rhyme off, but the challenges are unique. They really are. They're
mm-hmm.
different. And I say this a lot, and this comes out of complete respect, and I think anybody that hears me say this will understand this, but the Inuit are so innovative.
Mm.
They survived in the harshest climate
yeah.
for so many years
yeah.
for a reason, because when something's broken, they can figure out how to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this happening all the time. But you transfer that to the workforce, and it's scary because you may have somebody that says, I can fix that,
mm-hmm.
but they're not qualified to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And that scares me. As the leader of the organization, it scares me. And so a lot of my communication around that is that you need to be able to be qualified for the task you're doing. And
mm-hmm.
if you can't minimize the risks, reduce the risk or eliminate the risk,
mm-hmm.
and you can't do it safely, then it shouldn't be done.
Right.
And that comes from me.
Yeah.
Definitely don't want anybody doing something that they can get injured in.
Mm-hmm. 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 Hmm. So there's been a lot of talk over the last couple of years in south of 60, not north of 60, about our decarbonized future, a net zero 2050, net zero electricity grid 2035, although not quite so much talk about that these days. But it's completely different in the north because the challenges are so very different. Is there a pathway to a net zero future in the north, or is just the harsh realities of the climate that we deal with are going to mean that you know this is the kind of the maybe the one corner of the country where that the net zero future is not going to be realizable?
Historically, I think that Nunavut or the northern territories in Canada were the net part, right? The net part. So, you know, not able to get completely off diesel. But I think that the shift in mindset is important. So I think it's doable. I absolutely think it's doable. Because while we've seen the innovation drive lately, there's so many different things that you can get energy from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the industry will get there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of my job is to reduce the barriers for that to happen when it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you know, if the sun's not shining, you don't have solar.
Yeah.
If the wind's not blowing, you don't have wind energy, right?
Right.
So there is some challenges, but there's a lot of good things that are happening out there that can drive this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it can happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a while,
right.
But I think we need to have policy as well. There's no policy. There's no energy policy in Nunavut currently around that.
Yeah.
So we need to have some discussions and conversations about that. It'll help give utilities and energy producers a little bit more strength in what they're doing.
Right, right. So that future would likely include some of the things that we've talked about, wind, solar, hydro, storage. Sounds like storage is going to be critically important in the future. But here's one, maybe, you know, a little bit out of left field, but in your lifetime, do you think we would one day see small modular micro reactors in the north?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it makes the most sense. And I've been advocating. I know that commercially they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about micro.
Yeah, micros. Yeah, not the 300 megawatt SMRs, because that's
too big.
But micros, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, anything around 5 megawatts is almost perfect for, I would say, 70% of our communities, right?
Wow, okay.
And so they're really, like, I have an appetite for that. I know that there's a lot of unknowns, but it's a way to stop burning diesel fuel.
Yeah.
I have this vision of flying into one of these remote communities, which I do quite often, and you see the bulk storage tanks, you know, that are on the shore of a harbor, and you see our diesel power plant, and you get there and you can feel the thump almost in your stomach, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have this vision one day that there won't be that pounding generator in the background, and there won't be all those bulk storage tanks. I think it's exciting, and it's going to take some time.
Sure.
But I don't think we should just give up because it's hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so in your lifetime?
Yeah, in my lifetime, I think so.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So, Ernest, one of the things I ask folks that come on the podcast, even in person, is for a book recommendation. So we assemble the book recommendations onto our Flux Capacitor Book Club list. And I was, you know, chatting earlier, I'd mentioned that for the earlier ones, I've probably gone through half of them. Read a good chunk of those. Some of them I've been listening to on Audible. So what book are you going to recommend that we add to that list?
I'm glad you said that, because
You're an Audible guy, right?
I am an Audible guy. I'm a podcast person. I'm not a big reader, although I endeavor to someday. I just can't find the...
The time?
not the time, but it's the relaxation that... you know, I see people reading books and they really seem to enjoy themselves. That's not me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a leadership book is important to me because I think you know, employees are the number one asset in your organization, and treating them well is important. So leaders eat last. Yeah. And
okay.
It's, I think it's Simon Sinek that wrote that.
Okay. So why that one?
Well, it's my leadership style.
Okay.
I think that if you create a culture of health and safety and wellness and connection within your organization, you build trust with the people that work for you, they'll ultimately have a desire to perform more. And if you build that trust, and it has to be authentic.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just something that you can say, like you say you do. You have to live by action as well.
Right.
But if you build that trust with employees, you listen to them, you support them, and they will start to grow this infectious community of people that care about each other,
mm-hmm.
and work then becomes a little bit less intolerable.
Right.
Right. So you build this community. So, yeah, that's the premise of that book, and I think it's a good one.
It is a great, great addition, I think, to our list, and I am going to track this one down. So it's Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't, by Simon Sinek. Fantastic. We'll add that to the list. And Ernest, delighted that we were able to do this in person, which is awesome. So thanks for taking the time to join the podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on Instagram as the Brad Bradley, on Blue Sky as @FrancisBradley, on LinkedIn and through our website at electricity.ca. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page. This being episode 123. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Ernest's recommendation, Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't, by Simon Sinek. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.